geriatrician, the specialist in the care of the elderly. However, when it came to supporting her own elderly father who was affected by dementia, Dr. Todd found there was more to learn. We spoke with her about some of the tough decisions facing those who care for elderly loved ones, such as when to call for help, and even tougher, when not to seek help. We began by asking her how a carer or family member can tell when it is time to intervene and bring in more care for an elderly person.
Well, I think the first point to make is that the majority of older people live independent, healthy lives and manage their own affairs. So it's important that we don't assume that all older people are going to need formal care or to move from their homes. So the vast majority still remain at home and organise their own affairs. I think the red flags to me are where people are having lots of medical problems and are starting to lose the ability to do basic day-to-day tasks like prepare their meals properly, go shopping, losing the ability to drive or get out of the house, falls, incontinence, problems with memory. Those are all flags that need an explanation and an assessment.
You know, if the person is living away from their family, then it's going to be hard for some of those things to become obvious, you know, what they're cooking, how they're cooking.
Well, often they're more easily apparent to the visiting daughter from afar when you come in and you suddenly see quite a change in mother, whereas if you're seeing somebody day to day, the changes can be so incrementally slow that you both adjust to it. And the same with GPs sometimes, you know, GPs and their patients grow older together. And so sometimes a fresh pair of eyes that come in from afar is the first alert system that we have, because somebody sees that, oh, mother's not nearly as good as they were 6 months ago. But I think older people need to be aware that they do need regular health checks. I mean, we regularly take our cars to the garage for grease and oil changes, and older bodies are the same. You need to actually see your health professional regularly and talk to them about these issues. And most GPs are well attuned to the fact that some of these things aren't due to just normal ageing.
So if someone decides that, you know, an elderly person is going to need some sort of assistance, what are the sort of the lower level kind of interventions or help that can be given?
Well, the first level of care often is practically engaging, you know, neighbours and friends. So, you know, somebody takes the rubbish bin out, and there's a whole layer of informal care like that. If you need more help, then the avenues of help are your GP, who can refer you on to the local needs assessment services and older people's health services. Because if somebody's having trouble with cooking and preparing meals, what I want to ask is, why are they having problems doing this task? Is there some reason for it? And is there some way that I can assist them to recover? For instance, if you've suddenly got worse and can't cook, is that because you've got weak or you're too dizzy to stand up? So I want to look for the fixable things first, and that's very good counsel, whatever happens, you know. So why does the person need help now? Is there something I can fix to restore them to their old state of health? And if we can't, then the level of services that are available, we can provide domestic household help. That will include things like basic vacuuming and cleaning of the house, assistance with shopping if you need that. We can provide frozen meal services and Meals on Wheels. And then there's a whole range of services called personal health care services. So if you physically need help with getting in and out of the shower and having a bath, and that's often a frightening time for people who are a bit frail or likely to have falls, so those sort of services can be there. Then if you've got specific health needs or problems with leg ulcers, there's district nursing services that can come into the home and help with dressings and specific tasks. We have gerontology nursing services, which are specialist nurses who look after people who have complex problems at home, so usually several medical problems, and their memories might not be so good. and they're having problems with managing day-to-day tasks. So they need a higher level of monitoring, and those nurses are often good problem solvers, help coordinate the services and get in the right care.
And are those sort of services, you know, is access to them reasonably good throughout the country, or does it vary?
I think it does vary from region to region, but it should, you know, those basic services should be widely available throughout New Zealand. And often it's a question of getting through to the right place. So sometimes one has to be quite assertive with your GP to say, look, I'm needing help. Please, I think I need a second opinion. Please refer me through to, for a geriatrician's review, or please refer me through to the local needs assessment service. For the needs assessment services, you can actually refer yourself. So if you ring up your local district health board or your local hospital and ask to speak to the needs assessment service, you can explain what difficulties you're having, and that should be enough to trigger support and assessment coming your way.
Is it often a big step or a hurdle, you know, for someone who's been independent all their lives to either decide themselves or have a family member decide for them that someone's going to have to come in and do something for them?
Well, I think we are all very independent people and want to keep our independence, and I think that is a challenge. And I think we've got to clearly differentiate what the person actually needs themselves and what the family would like to allay their fears. They're quite different things. For example, my dad, who had a terrible problem with his walking and balance and fell regularly, he stayed at home for a long time after he was falling almost daily. He had stairs down to his workshop, and the thing that kept him well and happy was taking the risk of walking and getting to his beloved workshop, even if that meant, you know, falling over, losing bits of skin, constantly having a bandage on some bit of him. So, yes, people have difficulty accepting help, but they've actually got to need it, and you've got to balance up the risk. You know, what is the actual risk of not having the help, or letting the person do it for themselves? The sense of achievement of doing something, even if you do have the odd fall, may well outweigh the safety aspect of doing it for somebody.
I mean, it almost sounds like sort of with small children, you've got to have a bit of courage to let them go and find, you know, what they can do.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the biggest concerns I have, or that families come to me with, that mother's not safe, she might fall. Now, mother might fall wherever she's living, and there is some evidence to say that you fall less often in your own familiar environment. So people coming into the acute hospital or a new unfamiliar environment will often fall more often than in their own familiar place, where they've actually got steady handholds here, there, and everywhere, and have got a real routine to their care. So the strategy there is to make sure that if they do fall, they can get help as soon as possible. So we have phone alarms, Guardian provide a phone alarm system, or St John's, there's various systems there. You can use your neighbours to see if there's, you know, the curtains are up in the morning. You can organise the family to do phone calls each evening or after dangerous activities, like getting up in the morning and getting yourself to bed safely. Things like having a mobile phone in the house that they can take with them to ring. All of those are good strategies. And things like hip protectors might also be helpful.
So when you reach that point, how do you decide whether it is better to keep supporting, you know, someone in their own home, or, you know, to bring them into yours or set them up somewhere differently?
Well, one of the tests that I use is I say to myself, and often the families, you know, what would I be doing if this person didn't have any family that lived in Auckland, or didn't have any family that live in whatever place you live in? What could I do to support them at home? So if I could still support them at home, and that's what the person wants to do, and we can provide that safely with formal services, you know, the family still might be worried about them living on their own, but it's the person's decision and right to still stay there. And we can change ourselves, we can't change others. So sometimes families have got to learn to step back a little bit and let mum exist with the formal services and see how it goes. Because, you know, at my age, if I've got somebody living with me and I can ask them to do things for me, I'll choose to ask somebody else to do it. My niece currently gets to do the vacuuming and all sorts of tidying rather than me doing it. So, you know, if you're at somebody's beck and call all the time, they've trained you well. So sometimes as a carer, you've got to step back a little bit and let mum do it on her own with the formal services. And if that works, that's great. If it doesn't work, then that's the time to move.
If it comes to the point where, you know, someone decides that the person should be brought in to either, you know, live in their own house or have a granny flat or something like that, are there issues there that need to be thought of that people might overlook in their enthusiasm to, you know, do the right thing?
I think it's incredibly important to get a second opinion before you make those moves. And I'd go back to the principle of why does the person need that extra level of support? So looking to see whether you can actually improve the older person's function first is very important. And I think a fresh pair of eyes, like a referral through to a geriatrician or older people's health services, you might see a specialist nurse rather than a doctor or a specialist social worker, allows you to be aware of the full range of opportunities that are out there, because people in very good faith think mother needs high level of care, needs to move to a retirement village, needs to come in and live with them. But that may not be the right answer. Sometimes having more support at home for another few months and then making one move to a higher level of care, which the person's en route to, you know, let's face it, if you've got background Alzheimer's, dementia, and you live alone, there may well come a time when you're not able to live on your own. But having two moves is more distressful than having one plan move. So staying at home in the familiar environment, people often will function better with support and then just have one move to a higher level of care rather than going home, service department, rest home, or home, people's home, other facilities. And of course it depends on, you know, each individual is their own unique being and everybody's family circumstances are different. So, you know, this is just general advice. But I'd strongly advise a second opinion before you make that move, because it can be very expensive, it can be very distressing, it can have financial consequences for the family. I occasionally see families that, you know, build a granny flat or sell up a house and move in together at a time when the older person's health is failing so rapidly that you can see that it's not going to be possible for them to live long term at home. But meanwhile, the family finances have been pooled, and if you've got to move to a private hospital or rest home, there's some major financial consequences that the family might be liable for fees without, you know, the good advice first.
You referred to your own father. I mean, this is an area that's sort of your expertise, but when you came to start getting more involved in your father's care, what were some of the surprises or the extra dimensions that you came across?
Well, I'd call him the adventures of Russell and going in and out of hospital. He was in and out of hospital a lot, and some of the care was absolutely fantastic, but some of it was really incredibly disappointing to me as a geriatrician. And part of it is because of the genuine stress and rush and bustle in the hospital situations. Part of it's that, you know, the design of the environments is very poor for older, frailer people coming into hospital, and you know, that's the age group that acute hospitals are looking after. But, you know, there were episodes where he was told off for wanting to go to the toilet. There were episodes where he was told off for not telling them that he had MRSA, which meant that he needed a single room. And I know for a fact that both my father and I told the admitting doctors that he had it. But then to be really chastised for it later on was very galling. I think health professionals need to realise that caregivers are the experts in giving care to their individual loved person. So we know them really well. And even knowing the system, and with my experience as a geriatrician, I still had a staff nurse tell me that my father's risk of pressure areas wasn't high when he had a broken leg, a serious neurological problem, and he developed bilateral heel ulcers for the want of a pressure-relieving mattress within 12 hours of him being on that ward. And that made his last few weeks of life additionally miserable with pain, and it was totally preventable. And that's an attitudinal problem.
In general, were, you know, the levels of service and care that you would have expected to find in general, were, you know, were they there in your experience?
I think the technical care was generally excellent. I think, you know, the compassion and the attention to detail that makes people's lives bearable and happy often were overlooked. I mean, food was a huge issue for my dad. He had problems with his opening all of the containers that the food comes. So the food would be delivered on a tray with lids. He couldn't open the lids. Often the tray would be left on the bedside table out of his reach. The menu and the food that arrived had almost no correlation. My dad didn't like cooked vegetables. He was a salad and meat man. And did he ever see a salad? No. So he often got slurry as well. We called it slurry. When he was sick, he got soft, muley food. But, you know, there was a four-day delay between the doctors saying that he didn't need a pureed food and actually the menu changing. And in the meantime, you know, he just didn't eat because, you know, you'd lift it and it would be looking unappealing and things that he didn't want to eat. So one of the horrible things one day, I found him, you know, he was finally wanting to eat. I got there, his tray was on the in reach, but they hadn't taken the lids off, and he'd finally struggled and got the lids off the jelly, which he promptly tipped down his front and into the bed, and a similar episode with the ice cream. So I found him in tears. But then one of the happiest memories I have is when I'd gone over and bought $2 worth of chips from the local shop and brought them back, and he finished eating them because it was finger food, he could hold them, it was tasty, it was hot, it was accessible.
Which I guess must be frustrating for the carer when things get to the stage where suddenly a lot of the care is actually out of their hands, but they're not entirely happy with it.
Yeah, it's very frustrating, and I think it's doubly difficult as a health professional relative because you don't want to be seen as a pushy daughter or difficult daughter or whatever label. So, you know, we'd stand back and let them do their jobs, but, you know, and then, of course, there'll be these little things all the way coming through, and that just sort of makes you demoralised. I think it's very hard.
So getting from that, you know, very early stages of care through to what you're describing now, are there any golden rules that people should bear in mind about, you know, how to regard, you know, an elderly person or someone with dementia in terms of how quickly or how much you intervene?
Well, I think probably the most unifying thing about people with dementia is their diversity. So everybody's different. So there's no hard and fast rule about when to move, how to move. It really depends on their circumstances and risk. And everybody's different, you know. Some people have a high risk tolerance and others find, you know, caring for somebody with dementia just so stressful because the person is so different from what they were, even in the early stages, that to meet their needs is quite different from another family's need. I think some of the golden rules for me are, for caregivers, make sure you know about the disease or the illness that your loved one's got. You need to be informed, keep copies of all their discharge summaries and their medications and things so that you know as much as the next junior doctor that you come across. And insist that people tell you what's going on. You know, don't take your relative home from hospital if you don't know what's going on and they haven't sat down and talked to you. I mean, the highlights of our interactions with the hospital were when people actually rang you up and said what's happening and kept you informed with what the plans were and things like that. But you can also insist yourself, so, you know, and go to the top, find out who the consultant is looking after your relative and ask to speak to them or the registrar. Now, many house surgeons are very good and perfectly able to do this, but if you're not getting satisfaction from anybody and you don't know what's going on, make an appointment to speak to those people.
And there's no issue there of patient confidentiality, is there? I mean, does the carer generally have good access?
Well, I think I tend to do meetings and conversations with older people together. Now, obviously, if an older person is perfectly competent and able, they can answer all of their own questions and pass on that information to families. But even then, sometimes families need that information. And as long as the person's happy for you to talk to the family, there's no problem with confidentiality at all. Once somebody's losing their competence, then clearly to do good care, you have to talk to who's looking after them, so they have a right to know under the Health and Disability Code, and so, but you can't talk to every body in the family. You can only talk to the sort of the key closest person, you know, next of kin, enduring power of attorney, whoever has that role in that person's life.
And then beyond that, are the simple sort of things like a bit of humour or that kind of thing that are useful?
Well, I think in the role of a caregiver, you've really got to firstly look after yourself. As they say on the aeroplanes, you've got to put on your own oxygen before you can help somebody else. So you've got to look after yourself. We know that caregivers' state of health often is worse than other people in the community, so you've got to go and see your doctor regularly. And then what I recommend is that you've got to have a treat a week or a day, something that you look forward to. You've got to see the funny side of things. You must laugh. And I read in the Listener this week that you've got to laugh out loud 50 times a day. The other thing, you must be flexible. It doesn't matter if the dusting's not done today or the washing's not hung out by 9 a.m. You've got to be flexible. And you've got to also take time to enjoy the care together. So try and build in things that you both enjoy or time that you can enjoy things together. And probably my final bit of advice is to say yes. Turn off that no statement in your brain and say yes. So when people say, is there something I can do to help? Say yes. Now, often family and friends don't know exactly what they can do to help. So you've got to be creative sometimes and say, don't be afraid to say what sort of assistance you'd like. Even if it's just your friends and family coming round and actually sitting with your loved one for you know, lunch and an afternoon tea while you shoot off to bowls or go and have your hair done or whatever. Don't be afraid to, you know, organise all your troops and helpers around.